there, everybody. It's been a 007 back for episode 44 of Vassals of Kingsgrave's Agatha Christie linear reread. This is going to be another mini pod for After the Funeral, aka Funerals Are Fatal, originally published in March 1953. The plot concept for this novel is that a wealthy man dies at home. His relatives gather after his funeral for the reading of his will, during which his sister states that he was murdered. The next day, she herself is found murdered. Hercule Poirot is called in to solve the mystery. For me, this is a really fascinating Hercule Poirot novel, and I have a little bit of a sort of alpha-gamma rating for it, insofar as I really love the central mystery and how it resolves, but I do think it's a little bit padded and overwritten, as many of these novels from the 1950s are. As a result, it sort of averages out as second-tier Christie. As always, this podcast is going to be spoiler-free until the end credits music, at which point we'll get into the solution. So this novel comes hot on the heels of the previous in March 1953, but let's take a moment to consider the social change that Agatha Christie is documenting at this time of post-war Britain. We're still seeing the ravages of the war. Gordon Abernathy died in it. Poor Mrs. Gilchrist lost her shop. Here's a quotation. "I've always had a hand with cakes and scones. Yes, I was doing really well, and then the war came, and supplies were cut down, and the whole thing went bankrupt. A war casualty, that is what I always say, and I try to think of it like that. I lost the little money my father left me that I had invested in it, and of course I had to look round for something to do." End quote. So yes, we've talked a lot about war rationing and how food rationing lasted long after the war ended, but I think this is the first time we're seeing the impact of it on a small business owner, which is rather tragic. That rationing is still happening. Here's another quotation. "Bad judgment and bad luck. Been off his feed badly for 3 months. Worried, bad-tempered and irritable in the office. But since his uncle's death, that's all changed. He's like the breakfast eggs, if we had them. Sunny side up." End quote. So yes, not easy to get eggs in this period. But it's not just war that's disrupting life, also disease. Richard Abernathy is devastated that his only son has died abruptly from polio, which was an epidemic at that time. We see things that have been broken and not rebuilt. So there's a picture postcard with a pier that had been bombed and not yet rebuilt. And we have, I think, just this idea that those Downton Abbey-style old manor houses and fortunes are being frittered away and dissipated, and you can't get the staff to run those institutions even if you wanted to, and you certainly don't have the money. This is Christie's last major butler in a book, apparently. And you see a little bit of classism in the older generation trying to cling on to sort of gentility that's no longer part of the modern world, and a world in which these old houses are sold to institutions and not families. Here's a quotation about taxation. "I can tell you that the difference Richard's money will make will be hardly appreciable. This blood-sucking government will see to that. You mark my words, the whole lot will go in taxation." End quote. Probably a sentiment very much shared by Agatha Christie, facing high taxes on her fortune. And yes, just this general idea that civic order is cracking. "Didn't keep much money in the house, did she?" Miss Gilchrist said. "Very little." Mr. Guthrie sighed and rose to his feet. "Ah, well, there's a lot of lawlessness about since the war. Times have changed." And I think that's very much the theme of this book and many of the books set in the 1950s. Times have changed. And a lot of the crime committed in this period reflects whether or not people are willing to move with the times. So what's happened since the last book was published? That was in December 52, so it's only a couple of months. The events that would have been in the environment and in the air as readers received their new Christie are as follows. January 1953, Marshal Tito is chosen president of Yugoslavia. And on January the 19th, 1953, this is astonishing, 71.1% of all television sets in the United States are tuned into I Love Lucy to watch Lucy give birth to little Ricky, which is more people than those who tune in to Dwight Eisenhower's inauguration the next day. This record is never broken. Number one, the record's phenomenal. Number two, I Love Lucy is still iconic TV all these decades later. And number three, how do they know precisely it's 71.1%? But I do love that fact. In February 1953, James Watson and Francis Crick of the University of Cambridge in England announced their discovery of the structure of the DNA molecule, perhaps one of the most momentous things I've mentioned in all of these events. And in March 1953, Joseph Stalin suffers a stroke after an all-night dinner with Soviet Union Interior Minister Lavrenty Beria and future premiers Malenkov, Bulganin and Khrushchev. If you want to know what happens in the wake of this, you can watch the absolutely hilarious political satire, The Death of Stalin, written by Armando Iannucci. It's phenomenally funny, and I would highly recommend it. So, momentous occasion in March of 53, but also, equally momentous if not more so, Jonas Salka announces his polio vaccine. So, big scientific discoveries, big moves in Cold War politics as a backdrop to this novel. Okay, so let's get into the characters of the book. And I'll try and do so in order to give you a flavour of the very complicated Abernethy family. But there is a family tree in the novel, and it is very much needed and hugely helpful. So first of all, we have Richard Abernethy. He is the wealthy widower and, well, is he a murder victim? The family are gathered for his funeral. No one had even considered murder until one of his relations mentioned it. But he is the classic Christie wealthy widower, recently deceased and cremated, interestingly, which would have been very unusual. And is perhaps necessary, right, so that they have a little ambiguity over whether he was murdered before the start of the novel. He lost one brother in World War II and another brother and two sisters to other causes. He has only one surviving son, Mortimer, who has just died. So the poor guy is really bereft and without near relations anyway at the time of his death. So he's sort of dead off scene, but we learn a little bit about him. And it's his fortune that is the one that is up for grabs. His next in line brother was Leo, who's already dead at the time of the novel, but he has a wife, Helen Abernethy, who is a practical, loyal woman that Richard admires, and she is at the funeral. The next sister, Laura, is also dead, but she has a son called George Crossfetus. He is a solicitor for a stockbroker's office, and he's also at the funeral. Next comes Richard's brother, Timothy Abernethy, who's the only surviving brother of Richard, actually. And he's a very grumpy invalid, but he's quite a funny character, actually, because you never know quite how far he's truly an invalid or just being pandered to. He's very regressive and conservative in his views. Here's a quotation. "This country's full of gangsters nowadays, thugs over from the war, going about killing defenceless women. Nobody's got the guts to put these things down, to take a strong hand. What's the country coming to, I'd like to know? What's the damned country coming to? It all began with that damned Labour government," said Timothy, "sending the whole country to blazes. And the government we've got now is no better. Mealy-mouthed, milk-and-water socialists. Look at the state we're in. Can't get a decent gardener. Can't get servants," end quote. So, yeah, that I think sums up Timothy Abernethy. He's really unpleasant, but very, very funny to read. We then have his sainted wife, Maud. Very strong, healthy, tweedy countrywoman who basically sees to all her husband's needs. And she represents him at the funeral. Next comes Gordon Abernethy and his wife, who are both predeceased in this novel. So Susan Banks, their daughter, and Richard's first niece is at the funeral. She's married to a guy called Gregory Banks, who is a chemist. And they don't look particularly happily married, but she seems to be quite practical and interesting as a character. And they represent the first of the modern generation, I suppose. The next Abernethy sibling is Geraldine, who's also predeceased, but she has a daughter, Rosamond Shane, who is also at the funeral. She's an aspiring actress, and her husband, Michael Shane, is also an actor. They're both at the funeral. Here's a quotation about Michael. "Michael appeared at this moment, also yawning. He had a cup of black coffee in his hand and was wearing a very smart dressing gown. He looked haggard and attractive, and his smile had the usual charm. Rosamond was wearing a black skirt, a rather dirty yellow pullover, and nothing else as far as Mr. Entwistle could judge. The precise and fastidious lawyer did not approve at all of the young Shane's way of living. The rather ramshackle flat on the first floor of a Chelsea house, the bottles and glasses and cigarette ends that lay about in profusion, the stale air and the general air of dust and dishevelment," end quote. I think this is all rather wonderful. When you put that together with Timothy Abernethy, you sort of get a picture of old regressive England and its disapproval of change, and then this young, rather louche couple who are living a very modern life. So Agatha Christie, amazing at the age of 63, giving rather an amazing, holistic portrait of modern Britain. And then last but not least, we have Mrs. Cora Lansquenet, who is Richard Abernathy's sister. She's an amateur painter. She married a Frenchman She married a Frenchman in her youth that the family didn't approve of, so she rather lost touch with them. Her husband died 12 years prior. And the interesting thing about her is not just that people haven't seen her for a long while, but that she's seen as, in their memory at least, someone who would blurt out inappropriate things. Like, she doesn't have a filter for appropriate conversation. And she's the one, when she goes to the funeral, who says, "Well, he was murdered, wasn't he?" and sets a cat among the pigeons. So she lives basically in a little village cottage with Miss Gilchrist, who's her paid companion. She's the one who owned the tea shop until it was lost in the war that I quoted earlier. So now we've done the family of Richard Abernathy, and basically the result of the will is that all the living relatives effectively get an equal chunk of his inheritance, which is rather lovely for them in a time of high taxation and strained finances. This is all announced by Mr. Entwistle, the Abernathy family solicitor. He seems to have had very high regard for Richard Abernathy. And he's the one with whom all of these events don't sit well. So he calls in Hercule Poirot to investigate. The only other characters I wanted to mention, just because they are beautifully drawn, are Lanscombe, the butler at Enderby Hall. He's actually really wonderful and nostalgic and really does express that sort of Downton Abbey attitude of nostalgia for things past. Here's a quotation. "You'll understand, sir, that it's sad for me to think that this won't be a private dwelling house any longer. But I know how things are nowadays. None of the family could afford to live here, and I don't think the young ladies and gentlemen would even want to do so. Domestic help is too difficult to obtain these days, and even if obtained, is expensive and unsatisfactory. I quite realise that these fine mansions have served their turn." Lanscombe sighed again. "If it has to be an institution of some kind, I'll be glad to think that it's the kind you're mentioning. We were spared in this country, sir, owing to our navy and air force and our brave young men and being fortunate enough to be an island. If Hitler had landed here, we'd all have turned out and given him short shrift. My sight isn't good enough for shooting, but I could have used a pitchfork, sir, and I intended to do so if necessary. We've always welcomed the unfortunate in this country, sir. It's been our people. It's been our pride. We shall continue to do so." I think that's a rather lovely speech from Lanscombe, expressing patriotic fervour, but a very welcoming attitude towards refugees, because Hercule Poirot has come to stay in the house of Richard Abernathy under the guise of being someone who's going to buy it and turn it into a home for refugees. And of course, we're reminded that Hercule Poirot was himself a refugee from World War I, although interestingly, Agatha Christie does not mention it herself in this novel. The other character who I thought was interesting was Mr. Goby, who's a kind of private detective for Hercule Poirot. And he, like Mr. Timothy, is another comedically conservative man. Here's a quotation. "I've got what I could for you," Mr. Goby told the fire curb in a soft, confidential whisper. "I sent the boys out. They do what they can. Good lads all of them, but not what they used to be in the old days. They don't come that way nowadays. Not willing to learn, that's the way it is. Think they know everything after they've only been a couple of years on the job. And they worked a time. Shocking the way they worked a time. It's the government and all this education racket. It gives them ideas. They come back and tell us what they think. They can't think, most of them, anyway. All they know is things out of books. That's no good in our business. Bring in the answers. That's all that's needed. No thinking." So I think that's an interesting passage, because I'm not saying Agatha Christie agrees with it, but it is interesting to note that she herself did not have the benefit of a formal education and maybe has a similar idea about common sense versus book learning. I'm not entirely sure. Here's another rather interesting thing from Mr. Goby about the impact of government inspectors and on people's attitudes to being asked intimate information, which I find... Actually, probably I should have put this in the social change section, but I find this really fascinating. Quote, "Mustn't grab the government, though. Don't know really what we'd do without it. I can tell you that nowadays you can walk in most anywhere with a notebook and pencil, dressed right and speaking BBC, and ask people all the most intimate details of their daily lives and all their back history and what they had for dinner on November 23rd, because that was a test day for middle-class incomes, or whatever it happens to be, making it a grade above to butter them up. Ask them any mortal thing you can, and 9 times out of 10 they'll come across pat, and even the 10th time, though, they may cut up rough. They won't doubt for a minute that you're who you say you are. and that the government really wants to know for some completely unfathomable reason. I can tell you, Monsieur Poirot, said Mr. Gobi, still talking to the lampshade, that it's the best night we've ever had. Much better than reading electric meter or tracing a fault in the telephone. Yes, or than calling as nuns or the Girl Guides or Boy Scouts asking for subscriptions. Though we use all those too. Yes, government snooping is God's gift to investigators and long may it continue, end quotation. So I think this is fascinating. It tells us so much about English society at the time. The rise of sociology, the rise of the idea of taking statistics and household surveys and governing with the benefit of statistics, so people being sent out to ask everyday people their comings and goings. Also his little throwaway line of, if you want to get some information from a working class person, upgrade them to seeming middle class because they'll be flattered and they'll answer you. I think that's really spot on. And also he refers to nuns because there are a lot of nuns collecting money in this novel. So maybe that's just a good way of alerting us to the fact that, you know, there's all sorts of people who wander around. In his view, if you speak BBC, so proper English, and look like a government inspector, you can get anyone to tell you anything. So those are the principal characters. Is the novel progressive or regressive? How does it hold up to a modern reader? Well, I'm sorry to say, but the only person who I find really regressive is maybe the butler Lanscombe, who gave such a lovely speech about welcoming in foreigners. But here's another little description about Mrs. Cora Lanscombe. Quote, a Frenchman her husband had been, or nearly a Frenchman, and no good ever came out of marrying one of them, end quotation. And then Mr. Entwistle himself, although I think we're meant to rather like him. He is the guy who sets the investigation in motion and we think he has very good motives. But he's looking down on Susan Banks' husband, Gregory, because he's a chemist. Quote, a chemist's assistant, he understood. Really, a chemist's assistant. In Mr. Entwistle's creed, girls did not marry young men who served behind a counter. But now, of course, they married anybody, end quote. And I suppose this is a sort of watered-down version of the situation in They Do It With Mirrors, where Gina, who's, again, you know, the niece of a very wealthy person, has married a sort of working-class American mechanic. So I guess you're getting increasing ripples from class-crossing marriages, I suppose, because the war has thrown people up against each other, and all these things are now possible. Okay, so finally let's get into the adaptations of this novel. So there are two that I watched. The first is a 1963 film called Murder at the Gallop. It's one of the MGM films starring Margaret Rutherford as Miss Marple. So they've remade it as a Miss Marple novel. So in these films, they often play fast and loose with the plots. But this one actually does feel like it captures the spirit, if not the letter of the law, because the idea of this rich person dying, of a relation saying it must be murder, and the investigator infiltrating the family to find out what happened is all there. But as with the Margaret Rutherfords, the plot does play rather fast and loose. This is the closest of them. I found it really funny, actually. So I do encourage you to watch it. But she's very action hero. She's Murder at the Gallop, so she's on horseback for some of this. And she's also doing more of her sort of Sherlock Holmes type experiments. It is great fun, though, but it's not really an adaptation as such of After the Funeral. The more serious one, or the one that's closest to it, is the 2006 adaptation that was part of the David Suchet Hercule Poirot series. And this has a really, really phenomenal cast, which includes a very young Michael Fassbender as George, Lucy Punch as Susan, Anna Cole DeMarshall as Maud. I mean, it's really well cast. Monica Dolan's phenomenal as Miss Gilchrist. There are some changes, not least, I don't know why they felt the need to do this, but they make one, in fact, maybe I shouldn't say because that's a bit of a spoiler, but they do decide to put in a bit of transgressive sex that isn't in the novel, just, I guess, to kind of zhuzh it up. But the broad outline of how to solve the murder is in this. But they do also add like a faked will and all sorts of other stuff that for a novel that itself has a fair amount of padding, they seem to pad it out even further, which is bizarre. Anyway, to conclude, I would say that I think After the Funeral has really interesting characters. I think it's a phenomenally strong portrait of social change and what's going on in England at the time. And I think if you want to read Agatha Christie as a description of mainstream Britain, I think this really works incredibly well. I think the mechanics of the plot are superb, but it does feel like there's a little bit of padding in it and it could have been shorter and tighter and probably would have been if it was a novel of the 1930s or 40s. But with that, I hope you've enjoyed this little discussion. Stay tuned after the end credits music for The Solution, and join us next time for A Pocket Full of Rye. Okay, folks, so this is another one of those novels where you think you're meant to be detecting who in the family had the motive to kill Richard and desperately needed the money the most, as in novels such as Taken at the Flood or Appointment with Death. But the key is to realise that actually it's not a family member. And that, as in many other Agatha Christie novels, the first quote-unquote murder of Richard Abernathy is really there as a distraction. And she does this in many novels, back to Three Act Tragedy. I can think of many others where really she's hiding the primary murder amidst other murders that may or may not actually have taken place. So the solution to this book is that Richard Abernathy died a perfectly natural, if unexpected, death. And, you know, the actual murderer decides to take the opportunity to throw the cat among the pigeons. So the real murderer is Miss Gilchrist, and she has discovered amongst Cora Lansquenet's paintings that she buys secondhand. Cora Lansquenet thinks that she has an eye for art, but actually she buys complete rubbish normally. But she has, in this case, bought a really valuable painting but doesn't realise it. And so Miss Gilchrist feels that if she can get hold of this painting, she can reopen her tea shop. And this might seem like a really petty motive for a murder, but actually, all through the novel, you get incredibly beautifully described passages where she talks about what it means to her. And you sort of, as you're reading it, dismiss her as, oh, here comes another rambling, pathetic, oh, get over it, woman. But actually, Agatha Christie has played completely fair, and it is a very beautifully rendered motivation. Here's a quotation as Susan Banks is discussing opening a chemist's shop with Miss Gilchrist. You kept a tea shop, you said, didn't you? Yes, indeed. Miss Gilchrist's face lit up. That the willow tree had ever been trade in the sense that a shop was trade would never have occurred to her. To keep a tea shop was in her mind the essence of gentility. She started telling Susan about the willow tree. And she goes into absolute, oh, just beautiful descriptions of what it was. And there's a tragedy in Miss Gilchrist's story because she's trained for gentility and nothing else. So that when the war has taken away her tea shop, she has to become basically a servant. And she's always very keen to tell people, I don't do any of the rough, I don't do the heavy stuff. She doesn't want to slip. Her existence is so fragile. She's just one slip away from being truly working class. And so her pride is bound up with this idea that she owned a tea shop and she could again. Quote 8, quote, I had to look round for something to do. I'd never been trained for anything. So I went to one lady, but it didn't answer at all. She was so rude and overbearing. And then I did some office work, but I didn't like that at all. And then I came to Mrs. Lansquenet, and we suited each other from the start, her husband being an artist and everything. Miss Gilchrist came to a breathless stop and added mournfully, but how I loved my dear, dear little tea shop. Such nice people used to come to it. So this really is a novel that doesn't just speak to class division in England and how the war has made the barriers between those classes more easy to jump, and that's kind of given an unsteadiness to everyone, but also just how perilous that must have felt to a lower middle class woman who felt that she was on the brink of losing her gentility. So I think some might see it as a very silly motivation, but I see it as absolutely tragic and beautifully, beautifully essayed by Agatha Christie and beautifully portrayed in that David Suchet adaptation. Really worth watching on that account alone. So Miss Gilchrist needs to get hold of the painting, which means she needs to kill Cora Lansquenet because she will inherit not the house, but the bric-a-brac that's inside it. She covers up the painting in question because she doesn't want anyone else to spot it. So there is a smell of fresh oil paint in the house. And while Cora Lansquenet only painted from real life scenes, Miss Gilchrist has covered it up with a picture of a certain harbour with a pier, and she's painted it from a postcard. And this is going to get her into trouble because Cora Lansquenet's niece is going to know that that was painted from a postcard because that pier has been bombed during the war, so it couldn't have been painted from real. Before she kills Cora, though, she drugs her and leaves her on the day of the funeral at home and goes to the house of Richard Abernathy to hear the will dressed as Cora Lansquenet. And because no one's seen her for years, they kind of take her as given. And therefore, and disguised as Cora, Miss Gilchrist can therefore put the cat among the pigeons and say that Richard was murdered, which kind of covers, it gives a motive for Cora to be murdered. Rather than for the painting, it's because she had some knowledge of this murder. But this is another key clue. She's been practicing this very specific movement of the head that Cora did in a mirror. And Helen Abernathy realizes that there's something not quite right about this mannerism. So actually, it's this novel that should have been titled They Do It With Mirrors, because that's when she finally figures it out, that is becomes the kind of the prompt for the third murder. Another clue is that when she comes to the house as herself, as Miss Gilchrist, she mentions a certain sort of arrangement of wax flowers that were on a very specific table, but she couldn't possibly have ever seen them because they were broken at the funeral and put away. So only if she'd been there at the funeral would she have seen them, which means she was there as Cora Lansquenet. I think the only other end to tie up is that Miss Gilchrist very cleverly arranges a fake attempt on her own life, because obviously if Cora was murdered because she knew something, then maybe Miss Gilchrist is in danger too, because Cora could have told her they lived together. So she kind of fakes the idea that she was delivered some wedding cake and it's poisoned. But the only reason she doesn't die, she does poison herself a little bit, but she doesn't finish the cake. Because in those days, there was a tradition that if you put some wedding cake under your pillow at night, you dream of your future husband. And again, it's meant to make us pity her even more, this poor pathetic old spinster who's still dreaming potentially she might one day be married. So yes, again, it's a very, very moving character, I think. Perhaps one of the most moving murderers in Agatha Christie. But this is a very long-winded book. Like, some of Agatha Christie's are in the low 200 pages. Some are 300. I mean, this is 320. Helen Abernathy figures out who did it on page 240. And there's another 60 pages to go. So, yeah, I feel that this is a really great story if it had just been written in a slightly more taut way. But I love the characters, I love the detection, and I love the clues. I think Agatha Christie plays fair. First class Christie, but just with too much padding. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this. If you agree or disagree with our take, please feel free to leave a comment on the YouTube channel or jump on the Discord server and have a conversation there. Otherwise, join us next time for A Pocket Full of Rye. Thank you for listening. Thank you.